It's been described as a whodunit, and it has once again embroiled the Waccamaw County executive in a battle with his fellow Republicans on the county council. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Began with a November 19th, 2015 letter purportedly written by then Finance Director Leslie Lewis, addressed to County Executive Bob Culver, found by the county auditor. It recommended a raise, apparently, for the head of the Human Resources Department, Michelle Ennis. Lewis says she has no knowledge of the letter. Certified fraud examiner James Kern was brought in by the county council, but after initial effort to question employees, County Executive Bob Culver refused further cooperation. Council President John Cannon then found himself and his fellow council members on the receiving end of denunciations by Culver, who called the audit a witch hunt. And, of course, the audit eventually ended. Also, to take even more turmoil into the issue, Culver also fired the finance director in May. To sort this strange odyssey out, we have Greg Bassett. He's the editor and general manager of the Salisbury Independent. I must say, this sounds more like something coming out of Washington than it does out of Waccamaw County. Where do we start in terms of this conflict? I mean, this strange letter, which is like a few years ago, then suddenly kind of emerges and everybody's looking at it as if it's a great document. Give us some background.
Well, I mean, there's all kinds of personality conflicts that are going on here, a lot of dynamics, a lot of people with some egos. But this all goes back to an auditor's report in 2015, where auditors come in and they'll have a checklist of things that they want to look at. So they'll have employees bring them various files. And one of the things that was on the checklist was a review of the file of the HR director for the county, Michelle Ennis. In that file, they found a letter that approved her raise, that recommended her raise. And the letter looked suspicious to them. It wasn't written on county letterhead. Leslie Lewis's name did not use the middle initial that she's Leslie Martin Lewis, and she was very rigid about everyone using the M. So that is not there. The letter's not signed, but it's got her name and the name of an employee in the county who I still don't know, someone who is not high enough in county government that I could use them as a public source. So under the personnel rules, I do have to sort of protect their name, but I don't know the name. But it's someone who either works in the finance office or the HR office somewhere in the county who is not part of the big picture. So anyway, the auditors started asking questions about this letter. They went to Lewis since her name was on it. And Lewis is like, I didn't write that letter. I don't know what it is.
So at this point, they decide to hire an outside auditor or outside the fraud examiner. So what does he find? And what was his experience like in terms of dealing with the county executive?
Well, there are two things that happen. First is that the auditors do go ahead and close the books on 2015, the fiscal year 16, and declare that everything's in order. They don't have any big problems. But they did refer this letter to the county council's internal auditor, Steve Roser. Now, the internal auditor is someone who works for the legislative branch for the council, and the idea there is that he is free to see what the executive branch of the government is doing without interference. So it was referred to him initially, and then he took it to the county council, and they were like, we don't know what to make of this thing. We don't know if it's big or not. Among themselves, they couldn't decide how serious it was. At first, they were like, oh, my, yeah, this is serious. And then as time went on and they thought about it more, they couldn't decide how important it was. So they hired the forensic auditor who came in and did the investigation.
And so what did he find? What was his experience like with the county executive?
Well, you can argue he did everything wrong. But that's how these auditor guys are. They're not friendly, fun guys. They come in and they raise an air of suspicion and they drill on you. So he arrived last fall at the county government building, and he asked to talk first to the woman whose name is on the letter, other than Leslie Lewis. And as I said, she's not a higher echelon person. She felt very intimidated by the auditor. She admitted immediately that she wrote the letter, and she said she couldn't speak anymore unless her supervisor was there. So her supervisor arrives, and the county executive arrives with him, or her. I'm not sure if it's him or her. And now I think about it, it must have been her. But anyway, county executive arrives. He's like, what are you doing? Auditor explains his purpose. County executive, blindsided by this, was pretty offended. They had a tense interaction, and the auditor was invited to leave, that no more county employees were going to speak to him that day.
So, by the way, just let me get clear. So, the individual that she that he talked to, that individual said that they did write the letter.
Yes.
Okay. That has not only the employee's name on, but also Michelle Ennis's name on.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. It was the raised letter that went into Michelle's file.
Okay. So then you get this response by the county council of deciding ultimately to end the investigation, even though they spent a few thousand dollars.
Well, there's back and forth about whether the county executive was going to let people be interviewed by the auditor. In the end, the county executive, once he knew who wrote the letter and what the circumstances of the letter were, to him, there was no need for the investigation to continue. There was nothing left to find out. The council wasn't so sure, though. They wanted to know on their own. And the auditor was frustrated because he wasn't able to deliver a complete report. Not all the stones were unturned. He did not know exactly what happened. There's a conjecture, but he doesn't really know. So he wanted to continue interviewing the county attorney. County Attorney Paul Weber got involved. They agreed that employees could be interviewed with an attorney present if the stuff was recorded. That all fell apart. That never happened. So the auditor, in his report to the county council, said that he could not determine what had happened. And that audit cost $19,700.
Okay. So then you get a response from the county executive, Bob Culver, who, as a matter of fact, denounced the audit as legally reckless, a fruitless witch hunt, dishonorable and appalling. And then he emerges with his own emails. It all sounds very familiar.
Right.
So what did you make of the emails and what Culver said they represented? Because as I was reading John Cannon's response, Cannon seemed to indicate that it was all just still too vague.
Yeah, and that's the county council's pretty unanimous on it being all too vague. They still don't know what happened. When they're out at the Lions Club or the fire meetings and people say, what happened? They don't really know what happened. And it frustrates them, certainly, with an election coming up, not knowing what happened. But also the auditor, James Kern, who has 35 years experience, he presented his report first to the county council, and we were all shocked that his report went into the briefing book for the July 5th meeting of the county council with all the names redacted. And it was quickly, easily able, the reporters were able to figure out who everyone was, even with the redacted names. So that didn't really protect the people's names, right, and what was going on. He makes this report to the county council. There was even tension about that. Councilman John Hall, at the urging of the county attorney Paul Wilbur, had asked that all that be done in closed session. They decided to accept the audit in open session. Only one question was asked. Holloway asked whether Joe Holloway asked if, you know, the auditor, if people are normally uncooperative in these things. And he said no. It was like the first time ever that someone hadn't cooperated in this about the county executive. So they just sort of left it in the air. They accepted the audit. Then they released a statement saying, we don't know what really happened here. Then the next day, the county executive, Bob Culver, called a news conference. He read a statement of all of 1 minute. He was very upset, you could tell. He was angry. He was frustrated. He declined to take questions, but then he went out in the hallway and he did take some questions, but he blasted them with both barrels. The idea that, yes, it cost $20,000 on their end for the audit, but the time spent by his employees and by the county attorney was going to add to that expense. He felt like it was a witch hunt. He felt like they were opportunists, that something was going on, and the county council wanted to exploit that. But most of all, and the key to this thing is, he said that we do this all the time. So someone will create a letter that goes into the file that backs up the electronic form that they fill out that actually makes it all official. And maybe they're not so careful with that paperwork, so it looks kind of sloppy. On that letter, on that raise letter, the employee, Michelle Ennis, I think had been advocating for a higher raise. The first letter was written for a 12% raise for her. The county executive wrote on that letter, and it's his handwriting. The auditor wasn't sure at first if it was his handwriting or not. They were suspicious of that because it didn't look like his previous handwriting. But he says he wrote all over it. He reduced the raise from 12% to 8%. So he had seen the letter. But his point was, we write letters like this all the time.
Now, the emails that they refer to, so do they back up this idea that I mean, I think at one point I thought that it said that there was a different version of the letter in the emails. Is that right?
That's where I'm still confused, and I have more reporting to do. The county executive released a copy of the letter that mm-hmm. was unredacted, but it's a different version of the letter. So it's the letter with the underling employee's name removed and only signed by Leslie Lewis, purportedly signed by Leslie Lewis, seemingly signed by Leslie Lewis, who has maintained that she never signed the letter or saw the letter. In the email string, which I don't know how conclusive it is because it's really kind of muddled, there's a conversation where they're going to go meet the county executive to talk about some stuff. I don't think it's exactly this raise. I guess it was this raise and other things. And Leslie was told to bring the letter with her, you know, bring the letter along so we can look at the letter. So that would make it seem like she knew about the letter, but it's hardly conclusive.
Mm. So what is it? I mean, we get this fiery reaction by the county executive, but I'm reminded that this is not the first dispute that this county executive has had with the council, and he talks about people having political agendas. What's beyond, if we step back from just the scandal or whatever you want to call it, what else is going on here? Because it sounds like there's some other dynamics that are happening simultaneously.
Yeah, they're all flexing their muscles, and the county executive, again, at the end of this thing, said, I just wish they had come to me. If they had just come to me in the beginning, I could have explained what happened and none of this would have been necessary. The council's attitude is he would have talked his way out of it. We needed to do our job and keep him accountable. That's what the branches of government do. So that's their attitude. But he's the county executive. He wants to run things. He wants the council to follow him. And they don't always follow him. So in the budget, it was the same thing. There was a problem in the budget. The council cut taxes, surprisingly, shockingly. They had not done anything to indicate they were going to cut taxes. They cut taxes. They used the cuts. And they also added some funding to the school board for some school board programs that people had wanted in public hearings. And it was just a shocking list that they had turned in. Well, they weren't, because they were not involving the executive in what was going on, they didn't follow the rules exactly right in terms of the budget. So they ended up with a budget that was not balanced and had things miscategorized. So there was a back and forth about that. They only wanted to make right what they had done. The county executive wanted to open things up and renegotiate some other things in the budget. Because instead of spending the money on education, he wanted to spend some money on public safety. There was a back and forth about that. And they refused to engage him. So when they first cut taxes, his attitude, what he said over and over again, is if they had just come to me, you know, we could have worked this out together. And there wouldn't have been the mistakes made, which almost made the budget late. But it was all taken care of in time.
Are there any political ambitions by any of these council members that would make have some impact on whether or not on his own future prospects, that is Culver's future prospects? I mean, is there anything in the wind here as to why? Because, I mean, he seemed to implicate that there's more going on than just simply the traditional give and take between the executive branch and the legislative branch.
Yeah, the consensus would be that the county council president, John Cannon, will run for county executive. Now, he's never said that he'll run. He's actually made moves contrary to perhaps running. There was talk that Senator Addie Eckert might retire from the state Senate. John moved his house from Nutter's Crossing in East Salisbury out to the west side, so he's in District 37. So potentially he could run for seat out there. There's talk of that. He hasn't really shown to me that with his own business and everything he has going on that he really wants to spend the time to be county executive. He's obviously torqued at Bob Culver. It's obvious that they do not get along, which is fascinating to me because they grew up together in Salisbury. They've known each other their entire lives. John was from a sort of wealthy family, a power family. His father was a delegate and major property owner in town, very influential. Culver's from the other side of the tracks. He had to work a lot harder in his mind. So there's a very interesting dynamic that goes on there. But beyond John Cannon, I can't find anyone who really wants to run. There's no Democrat that I can find who wants to run. And there's some Republicans who don't really meet the threshold, I would say, to be like, you know, real like scary candidates at this point in a primary. Ironically, the primary is only 11 months away. And I say only 11 months. It sounds like a long time, but it's not in terms of politics. And the other thing that's going on there is when you've got the 7 school board races, the 7 county council races, you've got the courthouse seats, the judges are running. and all the legislators are running. It's about 24 open positions, 24 seats that are in play. Can we find 24 people to run for offices in Wicomico County? That's a lot.
By the way, how do you compare the relationship that, say, Bob Culver has to, say, somebody like Rick Pollitt? And obviously, Pollitt was on the other side of the party aisle. He was a Democrat as opposed to most of the Republicans on the county council. What difference in style did...
You know, Pollitt was everyone wanted to get along with everyone. He was a go-along to get along. He was probably the quintessential good old boy, you know, really connected to the county, knew everyone, very friendly, very affable. But he and Bob Culver fought. Bob was a council member and fought the executive a lot, joined by Stevie Prettyman. So they were sort of a tandem together, really beating on Rick, you know, his entire 8 years. So it's ironic that when Culver now is county executive, when the council wants to beat on him, you know, it upsets him.
So, I mean, at this point, because early on, I mean, I remember there was an issue about the Elementary School.
Yeah,
right. And you know, he came out with this thing, you know, and then Cannon and folks said, hey, you know, we've already decided, we've been through this. I mean, there seems to be, from his side of the aisles, it does seem as if he will go out and decide to do things or announce things or take positions without consulting the council people on the other hand. I mean, there seems to be, I mean, and that's what struck me initially when he came into office, is that all of a sudden you had these sudden disputes and you wouldn't think there would be.
Well, there's a couple of ironies here. The first meeting after he was elected, the first time they all got together that I saw was at a Chamber of Commerce forum. And Bob spoke first, and he said that he wanted to treat, even though he'd had problems with the executive as a council member, he wanted to treat the council as his cabinet, that they all had their expertise in different issues. So he would call on Matt Holloway for farming issues. He would call on John Cannon for small business issues. He would call on John Hall for advice about the airport, because John Hall has been the airport liaison for so long. The looks on their faces was that wasn't what they had signed up for exactly, but it's only the first day of school, so they're gonna get through this and figure out what's going to happen. But then that went off the rails very fast because he did try to change some things right away. And one was the West Salisbury construction project, and the other was phase three of the Bennett project. Now, I have to give Bob credit or understanding. He was saying what people had told him, that the people who got him elected, what they said. We don't need to spend all this money on West Salisbury School. Most people don't even know where West Salisbury Elementary is because it's out in a place that most people don't get to. It's not on the way to anything, if that makes sense. And same thing with Bennett. Like, what do we need all this money for these athletic fields for Bennett? There are people who you could argue just don't get it, but they were the voices that were in his head when he got elected. So he wanted to do things in a better way so he could tell everyone, hey, I tried, you know, and maybe made some success, maybe he didn't. But both of those projects were out of the barn. They were too far along in the process for him to change. But I do admire that he stuck up for it. I mean, he went to Bennett, met with like 300 high school kids and tried to explain his plan. They shut him down. They were like, no, this is, you know, we're going to get these fields. And it was very interesting to watch. And I think he learned from that. I do. But he tried to go out and do what his constituency asked him to do or wanted him to do.
So you think he's changed then over the years?
You're talking about him and Pollitt, yeah. The difference. He's much more hands-on than Pollitt. I mean, Bob is there every day. He's working. He's involved in everything that goes on. He's with Wayne Strasburg, who is a holdover from the Pollitt administration, works very closely with Wayne. He's very connected to county employees. You know, he's there all the time. Rick was sort of a different school. Rick was there all the time, was there a lot, but he wasn't as involved. He let the staff do more of the work. You could say that he like drove around and cut ribbons and sort of was the ambassador for the county, more so than Bob. But Bob Culver is in there with his sleeves rolled up every day working.
Now, one of the things that also struck me is that the Culver and the county were much more amenable to trying to figure out with the city about services and about the duplicate services. But then you have this sort of breakaway fire department, this volunteer fire company. And he seems to have gotten himself into a fix with that as well.
Yes. You know, so I can understand his point of view, too. He's got a problem out at the airport. Piedmont's going to stop maintaining the fire service out there, which they've done forever. Someone's got to do it. It's in the Parsonsburg district. But under the rules, you have to be at a burning plane within 3 minutes. So you have to have people staffed at the airport. The county's going to have to hire someone to go out there and staff it. Bob doesn't want to do that. So he thought, well, wait, we've got these renegade fire people from Company One in Salisbury. They're looking for something to do. Let's put them out at the airport. Apparently, they're interested in the airport, but they're not that interested in the airport. They're interested in having their own district on the east side with their own firehouse on Snow Hill Road. So that conflict is in play. Plus, you've got the fire services agreement, which doesn't allow for this, that's in play. So now you have another situation where you've got John Cannon representing one point of view on this. Jake Day, our very powerful mayor, representing another point of view, and then Bob. So there's letters going back and forth. There's a lot of tension about this. The firefighters involved, so that always makes it an emotional issue. It's a public safety issue, so it is important. But this thing is going to play out for a long time.
Why do you think that Cannon is reluctant to say, you know, to provide funding and or anything like that for these firefighters? Because my understanding, and particularly in local politics, volunteer fire companies have a certain political clout. And it would seem as if Cannon's saying, well, we're gonna put this group off. I mean, what's going on there?
I think if you watch in the meetings with the rebel firefighters when they talk, it's hard to put a lot of trust into them. You have to wonder if they really have their act together or not. Now, the mayor certainly has made it seem like that they don't, you know, that they're not wanted, and, you know, good luck to you, but, you know, you have no value to us. That's probably tainted them to a degree. They've also been pretty aggressive about what they want to do without really any belief that they can succeed at that. But the other problem that's going on here is that there's actually a very strong movement toward paid fire companies everywhere. So volunteers are sort of showing that they can't always get the job done. My grandfather was the fire chief in Ocean City. So for me to say this is sacrilege. But there's a feeling that the paid people have to be there to get anywhere within 3 minutes, that volunteers can't necessarily do that. So there's going to have to be a paid equivalent out there somehow at the airport.
So in this dispute with this particular company, and I mean, this reaches back. I mean, I remember they were going around about this when I first got here in 2003, 2004.
That was Station 2, though. That was a different station.
Yeah. What is it? I mean, but it seems like there were like these similar issues about reporting and so on. I mean, is it just simply the times have changed in terms of what the city is doing? Or, I mean, the city seemed to take a hard line even then with Station 2.
Well, Salisbury was always the only one with a paid fire staff, and that was only because the town burned down twice. So that's why Salisbury for a century has had paid staff. But it's these guys who are involved in firefighting volunteers, it's all they care about. I mean, they're really into this. So they're big proponents of themselves. They're proponents of their equipment. They spend a lot of money. I mean, there was the suit here where the volunteers who were kicked out of Station 1 in Salisbury, they wanted their equipment back. They valued the stuff that they had bought for the city to help the fire thing at over $700,000. A judge didn't necessarily agree that there was that much stuff, but you can see that they really were investing in their volunteerism and investing in the city. So they're very committed to this. And anything that messes with that commitment is always unnerving. When you have a paid fire chief telling them what to do, the chiefs historically would maybe give preference to the paid guys and let the volunteer guys do the grunt work. And that's not how it was historically. They had their own volunteer chief who gave them orders. The paid chief gave the paid guys orders. And the people at the top sort of worked it out. But now there's one unified chief in Salisbury. And the volunteers report to that chief as well.
Now, in fact, in all of this, Mayor Jake Day seemed like he just, you know, he went out there and it was this sort of this, you know, I don't really care kind of attitude. And I'm going to stand up to these people, I guess, is the impression I got. Is that was that because he felt strongly about it? Or was that because, in addition to perhaps that there was a strong support for him taking such a strong stand?
He was presented with statistical information that the volunteers were not getting to the site in time, getting to the station in time to report. And it was a consistent problem. There was a training problem. And he just declared that they weren't going to tolerate it anymore. They were going to get rid of the people who could not get there in time. Now, I remember when I was a kid, you didn't always go to the fire station if you're a volunteer. You go to the scene, you know. But all that's changed. Things have changed in terms of their procedures. And sometimes the volunteers wouldn't even go to the scene. They would just go to the firehouse, the station, and man the station in case something happened while the paid guys were out in the field.
We were speaking with Greg Bassett. He's the editor and general manager of the Salisbury Independent. And by the way, if you want to know more about the whole email letter controversy, a great piece in the Salisbury Independent.
Yeah, we have it from the beginning to end. So I think I've answered pretty much every question I've been asked about it. It's quite a long read, and I apologize for that.
And we appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thanks, Don.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.